the top stories, a military base hosting American troops comes under a drone attack in Iraq's Kurdistan region. Iran's Navy commander has hailed the presence of the Iranian fleet in the Atlantic Ocean over the and the Gulf of Finland as historic. Tens of thousands of people take to the streets in several Brazilian cities to call for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro. Welcome to the program. A military base hosting American forces in Iraqi Kurdistan region has come under a drone attack. The U.S.-led coalition spokesman says the attack has caused no casualties or damage. Earlier reports said a base in At al-Harir, northeast of Erbil, was targeted. This is the latest in a spate of attacks on U.S. facilities in Iraq. The Iraqi Resistance Coordination Committee on Friday vowed to continue attacks unless the U.S. ends its, quote, occupation of Iraq. The U.S. agreed in April to remove its combat troops out of Iraq, but has yet to provide a timeline. In January 2020, Iraq's parliament issued a resolution demanding the expulsion of U.S. forces. That followed the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Political commentator John Stepling says the U.S. always puts the blame on Iran for any attack on its forces in Iraq or the region.
You know, Biden has an important meeting coming up with Iraqi dignitaries in Washington, and this is kind of the theater that precedes those kind of meetings. This is always, you know, there's no casualties, there's no serious damage, etc. And the U.S. gets to blame it all on Iran. If you go to Reuters or even Middle East Eye or any variety of kind of mainstream and semi-mainstream press, you will read the same copy. So this is pretty much just, the kind of stuff the military turns out, hands to the press, they give them the copy. It's anti-Iranian propaganda. There's never any kind of evidence or deep critique going on about the actual reality in the region, or again, back to the original point, why the U.S. has troops there at all, why they ever had troops there. And that is the unspoken question always in Western media, certainly in American media.
Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi is to discuss the possible full U.S. withdrawal in his Monday meeting with the American president at the White House. Iraqi foreign minister said the talks will successfully establish a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. forces, but U.S. media have only pointed to a redefinition of the troops' mission. Meanwhile, senior Iraqi cleric Ammar al-Hakim said the talks should result in the ouster of U.S. troops from the Arab country. Anti-American sentiments have been running high in Iraq since the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January 2020. Right afterwards, the Iraqi parliament issued a resolution demanding the expulsion of U.S. forces. The Iraqi foreign minister says a deal on the withdrawal of the United States combat forces from his country, is imminent. It appears, however, that Washington is not willing to withdraw all its military personnel from Iraq. And the word withdrawal itself is in question since American forces will have an advisory role.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. it could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel.
The U.S. claims its 2,500 troops stationed in Iraq are focusing on fighting the Daesh terror group. Reports suggest Washington does not intend to draw down those numbers, instead seeks to replace them with personnel focusing on the advisory mission. Nevertheless, Iraqi National Security Advisor Qasem al-Araji says his country does not need U.S. combat troops on its soil anymore.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Beirut signs a fuel deal with Baghdad in a bid to ease Lebanon's energy shortage. Under the agreement, Iraq will provide Lebanon with 1 million tons of fuel oil annually in exchange for goods and medical services. Lebanon's energy minister said the amount of fuel will help the country generate electricity up to 9 to 10 hours every day over 4 months. Lebanon has been grappling with both economic and political crises. The country is facing a financial meltdown, with its currency losing over 90% of its value. Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. We discussed that, the regime's violence against Palestinians with the guests in our news review program.
And now, Palestinians have held a funeral for a 17-year-old boy killed during an Israeli raid on a village in the occupied West Bank. Mourners carried the body of Mohammed Muni al-Tamimi through the streets to the burial grounds. The teenage boy succumbed to his wounds at a hospital a day after being shot by Israeli forces. who shot during protests against illegal settlements in the town of Beita near Nablus. On Friday, hundreds of Palestinians gathered in Beita to demonstrate against Israeli aggression and forceful confiscation of their lands. Regime forces fired tear gas and rubber bullets, injuring over 300 ralliers. Palestinians have vowed to continue the protests until they take back their land. Joining us now for the program is Mona Candiel from Ramallah and Paul Larudi from the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Hope you're safe both and doing well. Mona, we're going to start with you to get the latest, if you could, please.
Well, on Friday, several protests and demonstrations took place across the occupied West Bank in the village of Beita, northern the occupied West Bank in Nablus. Hundreds of Palestinians took part in a protest against the building of an illegal settlement known as Aviatar. It was built on the lands confiscated from Mount Sabir. Palestinians were demanding that the settlement should be removed because settlers left the settlement. However, Israeli occupation forces were protecting the settlement and saying that they will allow the Israeli settlers to return back. We are speaking about over 320 Palestinians were wounded in this protest in Beita. In another place, in the village of Nabi Saleh, northern the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, another protest was held against the Israeli expansion of the Israeli settlements there, when Palestinian teenager Mohammed Munir Al-Tamimi, 17-year-old, was shot in the back, according to his relatives, and he succumbed to his injuries. Today, hundreds of Palestinians took part in the funeral processions that was held for Mohammed Al-Tamimi in his hometown village of Deir Nizam, northwest occupied Ramallah. Palestinians chanted anti-Israel slogans and chanted slogans against the Israeli crimes and aggression being carried out against the Palestinians, the peacefully demonstrating people against the settlements in the occupied West Bank.
Mona and Paul, welcome to the program. Your initial thoughts on this, Paul, and it's crazy, while Palestinians are fighting tooth and limb to try to get back land they've had stolen from them over the past 70-some-odd years, they're still having land taken away from them on a daily basis. Even today, it boggles the mind. Your thoughts?
Well, this has been the plan for Palestine for the last 100 years or so, to go by increments, to conduct ethnic cleansing and genocide by increments, to slowly increase the suffering and to expel by meters and even centimeters, to slowly colonize more and more of the land and to confiscate the land from the people who have owned it for almost 2,000 years. And so this is simply part of the continuing effort to do that. And the Israelis are becoming gradually more and more violent and brutal in their occupation because they're reaching, because they can, basically. Because the reports in the Western media, if they vary very little from day to day, no matter how brutal, if they slowly become more brutal, then a lot of the Western audience doesn't even listen to it. It's not even broadcast on the media. People don't know it's happening.
Thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe, both of you. Mona Candiel from Ramallah and Mr. Paul Larudi joining us from Berkeley, California. And that's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Iran's Navy commander has hailed the presence of the Iranian fleet in the Atlantic Ocean over the and the Gulf of Finland as historic.
Iran's navy for the first time entered the Atlantic Ocean a few months ago and entered the strategic regions in the world. This was a historic and unique move that had never happened before. Today, the presence of the Sand Destroyer and the Macron supporting vessel in the Gulf of Finland is historic and is happening for the first time.
Rear Admiral Hossein Khanzadi, who is in Russia, is set to meet with the country's high-ranking military and defense officials. Iranian Navy destroyer Sahandan, accompanying support vessel Macron, arrived in St. Petersburg on Saturday to take part in the annual parade celebrating Day of the Russian Navy. The parade will kick off on Sunday and will involve 54 ships, including frigates from India, Iran, and Pakistan. More than 4,000 military personnel will also attend the event. Iran has rejected the statement of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on protests over water shortages in the country's southwest. The Iranian Foreign Ministry's spokesman called the statement regrettable in terms of the extent of its invalidity. Said Khatibzadeh said the statement was tainted with false accusations and misinformation, calling the document interventionist and biased. He stressed that Michelle Bachelet's statement failed to consider the Iranian government's efforts to relieve the suffering of the affected population. UN Rights Chief on Friday expressed concern about the situation in oil-rich Khuzestan province. Protesters took to the streets in several Brazilian cities to demand the impeachment of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro. This is at least the second time this month that Brazilians demonstrate in several cities to condemn Bolsonaro and his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. He is now being investigated in the Senate, which is probing the possibility of corruption tied to the purchase of an Indian COVID-19 vaccine. Bolsonaro is gearing up for re-election next year in a race which will likely pit him against his political nemesis, former leftist president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Polls currently show Bolsonaro losing against his rival.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Firefighters have declared the end of their search for bodies at the site of a collapsed Florida condo building, concluding a month of painstaking work, removing layers of dangerous debris that were once piled several stories high. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled Search for Bodies in Florida Condo Collapse Ends with Death Toll at 97. Firefighters have declared the end of their search for bodies at the site of a collapsed Florida condo building, including a month of painstaking work removing layers of dangerous debris that were once piled several stories high. The collapse on 24th of June at the Oceanside Champlain Towers South killed 97 people, with at least one more missing person yet to be identified. The site has been mostly swept flat and the rubble moved to a Miami warehouse. Although forensic scientists are still at work, including examining the debris at the warehouse, there are no more bodies to be found where the building once stood. Except during the early hours after the collapse, survivors never emerged. Search teams spent weeks battling the hazards of the rubble, including an unstable portion of the building that teetered above, a recurring fire, and Florida's stifling summer heat and thunderstorms. They went through more than 14,000 tons of broken concrete and rebar, often working boulder by boulder, rock by rock, before finally declaring the mission complete. Miami-Dade Fire Rescue's Urban Search and Rescue Team pulled away from the disaster site on Friday, 23rd of July, in a convoy of fire trucks and other vehicles, slowly driving to their headquarters for a news conference to announce that the search was officially over. At a ceremony, Fire Chief Alan Kaminsky saluted the firefighters who worked 12-hour shifts while camping out at the site. "It's obviously devastating. It's obviously a difficult situation across the board," Kaminsky said. "I couldn't be prouder of my men and women that represent Miami-Dade Fire Rescue. The disaster was one of America's deadliest engineering failures." Officials have declined to clarify whether they have one additional set of human remains in hand that pathologists are struggling to identify, or whether a search for that final set of remains continues. That 98th victim is believed to be Estelle Hedaya, an outgoing 54-year-old who loved to travel and was fond of striking up conversations. Her younger brother, Ike, has given DNA samples and visited the site twice to see the search efforts for himself. "As we enter month two alone, without any other families, we feel helpless," he told the Associated Press on Friday, 23rd of July. The collapse also fueled a race to inspect other aging residential towers in Florida and beyond, and it raised broader questions about the nation's regulations governing condominium associations and building safety. Shortly after the collapse, it became clear that warnings about Champlain Tower South, which opened in 1981, had gone unheeded. A 2018 engineering report detailed cracks and degraded concrete support beams in the underground parking garage and other problems that would cost nearly $10 million to fix. The repairs did not happen, and the estimate grew to $15 million this year as the owners of the building's 136 units and its governing condo board squabbled over the cost, especially after a Surfside town inspector told them the building was safe. A complete collapse was all but impossible to imagine. As many officials said in the catastrophe's first days, buildings of that size do not just collapse in the United States outside of a terrorist attack. Even tornadoes, hurricanes, and earthquakes rarely bring them down. In the weeks after the collapse, a 28-story courthouse in downtown Miami, built in 1928, and two apartment buildings were closed after inspectors uncovered structural problems. They will remain shut until repairs are carried out. The first calls to 911 came about 1:20 a.m. on 24th of June, when Champlain residents reported that the parking garage had collapsed. A woman standing on her balcony called her husband, who was on a business trip, and said the swimming pool had fallen into the garage. Then, in an instant, a section of the L-shaped building fell straight down. 8 seconds later, another section followed, leaving 35 people alive in the standing portion of the building. In the initial hours, a teenager was rescued, and firefighters believed others might be found alive. They took hope from noises emanating from inside the pile of debris that might have been survivors tapping, but in retrospect, the sounds came from shifting debris. The dead included members of the area's large Orthodox Jewish community, the sister of Paraguay's First Lady, her family and their nanny, as well as local salesmen, his wife and their two young daughters. Meanwhile, a Florida judge has approved the sale of the collapsed oceanfront property, with proceeds from the sale intended to benefit the victims of the disaster. At a hearing, Miami-Dade Circuit Judge Michael Hansman ordered that process begin to sell the site of the Champlain Tower South, which could fetch as much as $100 million, according to court records.
Food for thought.
Salam, and let us begin the day by contemplating on what the Prophet's 10th infallible successor, Imam Ali an-Naqi al-Hadi, peace upon him, has taught us of the merits of performing the ziyarat, or visitation, to the shrine of Immortal Martyr of Karbala. There are definite places in which God likes the servants to supplicate to him. One of these places is the tomb of Hussein, Master of the Martyrs, peace be upon him.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, God bless his great soul, and I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I have Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, academic, scholar. Welcome to the program, sir, on your contribution and insight on Imam Khomeini.
Assalamu alaikum, thank you very much.
Brother, we've been talking a couple of sessions now on the theme of polarization, a very important theme, and something that carried on from, you know, the days of the revolution into the imposed war. That's when Saddam, backed by, you know,
everyone,
yeah, almost everyone. And it comes back to that theme of polarization, of course, because, you know, Iran was completely alone in that war.
Except Syria,
yes. You know, everybody backed Saddam to, you know, basically overthrow the revolution. And, of course, you know, Imam Khomeini, with this great personality from the teachings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon him, you know, is fighting this war exactly like the way Imam Ali, alayhi salam, fought his wars. And that is uncompromising. You know, justice needs to be done.
Yes.
Because, you know...
Well, we all know... Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Exactly. No, please.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We all know... You know, greatest soldier ever, Imam Ali al-Islam.
Exactly.
Greatest military person.
Exactly.
I'm talking about not, you know, you see people are like, oh, what does that mean, you know, today? Mm. I'm talking about personality, military personality.
Yes.
Obviously, with the given technology and the circumstances of the era.
Mm.
But, you know, somebody who the mere mentioning of his name, you know, makes the enemy flee.
Flee. Exactly.
So...
Or tremble with fear.
Tremble with fear, and literally, you know, wet their pants.
Exactly.
Which we have several cases of that happening.
Of course, literally happened.
Literally happened.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
So that's true.
It's not a...
No, we're not making it
We're not making it One of the names for Imam Ali alayhi salam is Haydar al-Karrar.
Exactly.
Karrar is literally means the one who keeps attacking.
And that would be... Exactly.
Which is the opposite of Farrar, which is somebody who flees.
Flees, exactly. And we have on record who
yes.
fleed where
they fleed.
Yeah, well, let's not go there.
Let's not go there.
Right.
But the main thing is that as far as Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, because he comes right out of the teachings of the
Ahlul Bayt. He's not scared
and
of
course,
war.
And, of course, his great love for Imam Ali
right.
definitely is there. And we see that in his personality, that he's the one who keeps saying, no, the war will not stop until our demands are met.
And until Saddam, the initiator
of this
war, the one
war,
who killed innocent people,
mm-hmm,
the one who
punished.
Transgressed against every Islamic international custom and law and everything that everybody knows in this world was his fault and all the crimes that he committed, until he is punished.
Punished.
It's not simply about...
Yeah.
You know, driving him out of the Iranian territory any longer.
It's about punishing him.
It's somebody who is a criminal has to be punished.
Exactly.
For the damage they have done to other innocent human beings. Okay?
And Imam Khomeini
now,
is uncompromising
now,
in that.
Now, imagine saying this, and you have a lot of people around you being like, well, no, this
well,
is...
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And, of course, this is going to repel people. Of course, this is going to make some people feel like, you know... You know, why? Let's just kick him out of the country, whatever. Okay? Which is what they were talking about.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, sure.
So, the point is that you have this unjust, unfair, imposed war.
Sure.
And it's not just Saddam. It's like,
no.
It was like Saddam attack. Well, Saddam was the instrument with which all these nations united
attacked.
To
yes.
kill the Islamic revolution.
Yes. And this was unprecedented because, as you and I know at the time, you know, the Soviet Union
yes.
and the Americans were at first, you know, they had common ground all of a sudden.
Right. They had the same language.
They had the same language.
Just like Israel and
Saudi
Arabia
have the same language
now.
They had the same language at the time to get rid of Imam Khomeini out of Iran. So
not only Imam, to get rid of the Islamic Revolution.
Revolution.
Because
yeah.
all their... Battle all their unjust and evil schemes and plans
yes.
and profits that they were making and
sure.
domination that they had,
mm.
especially in this strategically important area of
sure.
the Middle East,
sure.
West Asia,
mm.
was being threatened.
Sure.
Okay?
Mm.
So, the point is that
yeah.
that's when you see this hardcore personality coming through.
Sure.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You have a hardcore personality like him. You have this personality who is not simply trying to, you know, compromise with an evil criminal, you know, mind in terms of, you know, or an actor like Saddam or his supporters or the Zionists or whoever it is.
True.
Even though a lot of people are saying, you know what? Let's just, you know, there was that famous thing during the war. A lot of people who know the history of the war,
sure.
where you had the president who was then, you know, who then fled. In wearing women's clothes, Benny Saad.
Right.
He basically said, we have to have a strategy where we give territory and we win time.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, militarily is just...
It is ridiculous.
Ridiculous. Because
yes.
the whole point is territory.
Yes.
The point is to get back territory in quick, in a lot, in the shortest time.
Shortest possible.
Right. So a complete, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know,
yeah.
amateur when it comes to military affairs.
Sure.
And, you know, whatever. So Imam at that time is completely standing against that person who, and then, you know, that was the conflict that they got into because he was saying, oh, I have the people's votes and you don't need to tell me what to do. I know what to do, blah, blah, blah. In the end, Imam's like, you know what? You're not worthy of the presidency.
Yes.
And the parliament, you know, impeached him.
Oh, impeached him.
Yeah.
Right.
And he went into the arms of the munafiqin, of
yes.
the terrorist cult
yes.
around, you know, those...
So he was really exposed for what he was.
Right. And in the end, he ended up shaving his ridiculous little mustache,
yes.
putting on women's clothing, and fleeing to Paris.
Oh.
Right? So this is the deal. And basically what you see is that Imam, from the very beginning of the war,
mm-hmm.
is taking a very hardcore strategic view of this. He's not only looking at the daily battles and, you know, this kind of short-term, well, let's see what we can do here, then let's see what happens afterwards.
Yeah.
He knows from the very beginning how this thing is going to have to end up.
Sure.
Strategically, historically.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay?
Yes.
So, forget about those things that are happening internally. You have insurgency being started in Kurdistan by Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
This is before the
war actually started.
It's actually 2 years before that, where you have Sheikh Chamran going in and the local people joining together with the Revolutionary Guard and, you know, defeating the Saddam-backed Kurdish terrorists. You have the military coups that are being attempted in Iran.
Yes.
The Nojeh coup, where you have former officers being paid by the Americans to, you know, conduct a coup. You have, you know, disturbances in different parts of the country.
Of course.
So there's a million things going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the war. And here's an 80-year-old man, and he's managing it.
Yes, he's managing it.
Right?
This is what you call faith and trust in God.
Right. And he's managing it not in the sense of, you know,
yeah.
Saddam, well, yeah. I will, if you don't do this, I'll chop your head off.
No. I mean, it's not like he's got detailed plans and charts all in front of him. He's a man who's...
He's managing it based on certain principles. Because he knows that these principles, which are from God, will get you the result.
The result.
The most important being that you, as a leader, are not scared, do not have fear, you trust Allah's, you know, power over everything else, and you don't consider yourself anything.
Exactly.
In the face of God.
Exactly.
And he has that famous line, I will never forget that line, where, you know, the soldiers are there in Jamran, you know those films, which is like just amazing. You know, the soldiers are coming to see him before they go to the front in Jamran.
Yes.
And he's holding a speech. You know those Imam speeches.
It's fun,
And he says to them, he says, you're not my soldiers. Because I think they were chanting something, oh, we are your soldiers, or something like that.
No, he said, you're
he
not,
said,
my,
you're not my soldiers, soldiers and I'm not your soldier. We are all God's soldiers.
Soldiers. And you do not belong to your parents, you belong to the Imam.
Okay, so this is the things that... This is the kind of leadership you require in these times, okay?
Yes.
There's many examples.
Mm.
You know, they attack, there's problems, he gets rid of them, because remember, the president is the commander-in-chief.
Chief.
So he gets rid of the commander-in-chief. He says, you're no good for this.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
He insists on the Revolutionary Guards being established as a revolutionary military force.
Sure.
He insists on the besieged force being established. And he says, we need an army of 20 million.
That's right. Yes,
okay.
Where have you reminded me? Yes,
he says, we
right,
need
right.
an army of
20 million. Yes, and there was that famous poster with one guy holding up that banner of La ilaha illallah, and you have all these multitudes behind them.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, he doesn't dissolve the army.
No. He actually wants to...
Listen, this is a big move by Imam.
It's
a super hardcore, you know,
move.
Because all these left-wing, you know, munafiqeen, all these, you know, radical groups
they
are
want
saying,
to disband the
let's
army.
Get rid of the Shah's army. This is the Shah's
that.
Army. We will be the army.
Yeah.
And Imam's like, no, these are good guys.
These are good guys.
These guys, it's not their fault.
No.
They were in the army. They were serving their nation. They were defending their country.
Okay.
Honorable men.
Yeah.
Most of them religious in their private lives.
Sure.
You know. We have to keep them. Not only do we have to keep them, we honor them.
Honor them.
They themselves know what to do. They don't need American advisors.
Yes.
They know themselves what they have to do.
Yes.
They are better than the American advisors. They know how to defend their country better than foreigners.
Yes.
So he keeps the army. He establishes the Revolutionary Guard. He establishes
Basij.
He gets rid of the...
yeah.
That getting rid of Bani Sa'd was just brilliant.
Brilliant.
Know?
Yes, it was.
He's like, dude, you're out of here. Okay?
Yeah. Mm.
He's dealing with the coups. He's dealing with insurrections. Okay.
Yeah. And the other fact that, of course, you know, right at the outset as well, that many of those who masterminded the revolution as well, who later on became the government, they were assassinated by those very...
Exactly. We had the big...
And the Americans were thinking, we're onto the big one here, because
remember,
about 72
this is actually,
of them...
You reminded me of a very important episode. All of this, we're telling these episodes and these... So people know the history.
Yeah.
So they understand the personality of this person. You know, you have this thing of Imam, and you know, in the West especially, people don't know his real personality.
Yeah.
So the first person that they kill after the revolution is who? Is Shahid Muqtadi.
Shahid Muqtadi, yes.
God bless his great soul. Okay? The first person they kill is Shahid Muqtadi, who's one of the leaders, the clerical leaders, who's a smart person.
Yes.
There's a famous story where you have the leaders of the Munafiqeen cult coming to see Imam.
Yes.
And they have a camera with them.
Mm.
And it's clear what they want is they want to take a picture with Imam and then go around the world saying, oh, Imam has given us the approval that he's with us.
Sure.
And Imam, since before the revolution, had declared them to be non-Muslims.
Yes.
And giving money to them is haram as yes. As homes, because yes. people had asked them.
Sure.
So they make it in front of the door of Imam's room with the camera. This is how far they are able to get.
Yeah.
And Shahid Motahhari happens to be there. And he says, what? You want to take this camera? No, Imam doesn't want you to take a picture. They're like, no, no, no. And you know the whole Iranian Eastern kind of taught off. And no, halal, okay, so it doesn't matter, so let us take it in, blah, blah. You know what Shahid Motahhari does? He takes the camera and he smashes it. Right there. He says, I will not let you take a picture with Imam. You see? Another, you know, this is what you do for truth.
Truth.
They are trying to, you see, this is the way munafiq
yeah.
and people who are hypocrites and people who don't really believe the truth but have to live with the fact that there are
yeah.
people who actually stand up for truth, and that they can't just openly, they try to do it through, you know, indirect and sneaky ways. And then a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, a person like Imam Khomeini, a person like Shahid Motahhari, when they stand up to them and actually break the camera, which is the tool for them to want to do their nifaq and want to do their, you know, propaganda, well, obviously they're going to cause enemies. And what do? They kill him.
Yes.
And what a great shahadat that is.
Yes.
To be killed by the enemies of truth.
Exactly.
Right? So, the first person they kill is Shahid Motahhari, and you have the funeral for Shahid Motahhari. This is 2 months after the revolution. I'm talking about the personality of Imam.
Yes.
Remember, didn't cry when his son was killed in Najaf.
No.
Everybody who was there in Najaf said Imam did not cry at the ceremonies for his son.
Sorry.
Didn't cry when he arrived. Didn't cry at the... No, nothing.
Nothing.
How do you feel? Nothing.
Each.
He's crying at Shahid Motahhari's funeral.
That's right.
Okay?
Yes,
the only person funeral that he cried at was Shahid Motahhari's.
Yes?
Why would he do that? Because he is a person who is embodiment of this polarization. He's the one that wrote the book about the polarization
of Imam Ali.
Right?
Yes.
I'm not saying this is the only reason. I'm saying Imam knows who Shahid Motahhari is.
That's why he
Imam knows, you know, who's been martyred. He's crying on the one hand because he's happy for him that he's martyred.
Martyred.
And that he got to his goal.
Cool.
Right? And on the other hand, he's just thinking about, you know, this humanity. These are the people they kill. The way they kill our Mullah, the way they kill all the good ones.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes?
So Imam is crying at Shahid Motahhari's funeral. And the only other time he cried, that we saw him cry, was during Ashura and during Muharram.
That's right.
The ceremony.
Yes.
Okay, we didn't see him cry anymore.
No.
And what does he say at Shahid Motahhari's funeral? This is important.
He said, this is my son.
Besides those things,
yes.
You know what he said? He says, killing us is not going to stop the revolution.
Ah, yes. Excellent.
This revolution is dependent on nobody.
Nobody.
Even if I am killed,
yes,
even if I am killed, the revolution
will
continue.
The revolution.
And just a note for those gentlemen who all these years insist that if they are not around, then the revolution will stray.
No, that's not the case.
Yes. Imam said, even if I'm not there, the revolution will
continue.
Because it's not about
personalities.
It's about Islam. It's about Haq.
Haq.
It's about people standing up for Haq, which the people have.
Yes.
Okay?
And there's always somebody else in the wings.
So, they're thinking, oh, we got one of the main dudes.
Yeah.
Then they go kill the 72.
The usual,
you know,
insane type
They
thinking,
kill Shahid
yes.
Beheshti and the 72 members of the Islamic Republican Party.
Party, yes.
Which is considered the elites and the top management of the revolution.
The masterminds of the revolution.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And thinking, well, that's it.
That's it.
It's
We've
all
done it.
It. Well, it's not.
They didn't do anything.
That's it. Right?
Yeah.
So, the point is, so we have all this stuff going on. We've got the war then going on, and he being a decisive commander.
Sure.
He's saying, for example, he's saying this city has to be liberated.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
This city, that city, this battle. And then Khorramshahr, which was the main city that the Iraqis had held for years, is liberated.
Yes.
Through the, you know, this ongoing struggle. The revolutionary forces, the Islamic Republican forces, are able to the Iranian forces are able to liberate Khorramshahr. And what does Imam say?
God liberated.
God liberated Khorramshahr. Right?
It's a totally different world.
Right?
Yep.
Doesn't mean that people didn't struggle.
No, no.
Doesn't mean that he's not...
But the victory is attributed to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Victory and defeat and everything is in God's hands. If you won, don't get arrogant.
Don't get arrogant.
If you won the victory, don't get arrogant.
This is a blessing from Allah.
When they were using chemical weapons, he forbade the use of chemical weapons against the Iraqis.
Yes.
People were saying, well, what does that mean? And, you know, we can respond in kind in Islam, and it's not a problem. And he's like, nope.
No.
We will not use chemical. This nation, which is under the banner of Islam, will not use chemical weapons against other Muslims.
This is principle. This is truth.
Right.
Yeah. And the other thing that we were mentioning before we came on air was the fact that, you know, the Imam gave this very powerful command to sink an American ship.
Well, when the Americans entered the Persian Gulf, under the guise of protecting, shipping lanes.
Oil tankers, yeah.
The first thing he said is, sink one of them.
Sink one.
And, well, they didn't, for various reasons.
Yes.
And the justification for not doing it was, well, the Americans are going to enter the war.
Yeah, but they entered it
anyway. And then they entered it anyways.
Yeah.
So
if they had listened to the Imam.
So if they just listened to the Imam.
They wouldn't have entered the war.
I'm not saying the Americans wouldn't have entered, but... Well, if they're going to enter it anyways, you might as well, give them a little warning, a little deterrence, as they say.
A little deterrence.
A little thought along the way if you want to get involved.
Well,
things are going to happen.
Mm.
And so this is the deal. When you have a hardcore person like Imam, who's not scared, he has to go back. It goes back to being not scared.
Scared.
And how is it that you're not scared? Again, for me, this is theoretical because I'm scared all the time.
Okay.
So what I'm saying, it's not that I'm not claiming that I have this mastered in some way.
Mm.
Why is Imam not scared? And remember his famous quote. He swears by, the unity and oneness of Allah, that I have never been scared of anyone except for Allah. Remember, this is a big.
No, this is big. This is very important.
It's big.
That's just like our imams.
Right. It's big.
It's big.
It's not a small statement.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why isn't he scared? It's because he has complete trust in Allah.
Of course.
I mean,
Allah will do things.
It sounds simple.
Which is beyond human imagination.
It sounds simple, right?
Yes, it does. But it's deep. Things happen, which we can't imagine.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, what would have been the consequences if you had actually sunk an American ship?
Well, I would argue minimum is the Americans would think twice.
Think twice, yes. Or would have let the Soviets deal with the problem.
Well, all I'm saying is that, your action has an effect on things.
Of course they do.
Okay? Mm. So, let's say they had done that.
Yeah.
Maybe, I'm not saying, things would have been greatly different.
Sure.
It's the principle of it.
Mm.
If you're going to enter our territory, if you're gonna enter our area, you're going to have to pay for it.
You're going to have to pay for it.
All right? If you want to, go ahead, but you're going to have to pay for it.
Exactly.
Okay? So, this is the deal. Mm. This is what a real... You see, we have this thing in the West where it's... Defense is a necessary evil.
Yes.
This is the way they justify it in the West.
Yes, that's right.
Especially in the Christian tradition.
Yes.
They say it's a defending yourself militarily is not evil. No. It's good.
It's good.
It's not a necessary evil.
Mm.
It's good. It's just.
That's what you have to do. Naturally, that's
it's
what
just. It's the embodiment of justice. It's the embodiment of righteousness.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a necessary evil to defend yourself.
Sure.
Yes, going to war, getting killed, killing, maiming.
Yeah.
These are not pleasant things to do.
Sure.
And I don't mean pleasant in the if you're fighting against shaitan, it's actually quite pleasant.
It is.
Okay? It's not a,
It's not
like
a part-time hobby.
It's pleasant in the sense that you're doing a righteous act. It's like, you're doing something good.
Yes.
So it shouldn't cause you trouble. And by the way, can I just add something? This came to my mind right now.
Please.
Notice that how in Iran we don't have the psychological problems among people who go to war as you have in all other countries.
Yes, that's a very good point. I mean,
soldiers don't commit suicide.
Suicide when they come back.
I'm not saying people aren't shell-shocked, some of them.
No, of course they do
This
suffer.
Is a natural physical reaction to some of the things.
The traumas
but we
of
don't
war.
Have that thing of, you know, veterans returning and becoming, you know, heroin addicts.
Yes,
we don't
psychopaths.
Have, you know, the more amount of people, you know, Vietnam veterans killing themselves from suicide than actually died in Vietnam.
Malam,
you know, we don't have that stuff.
No.
Why? Because in our view, which is the view of Islam, which is the Islam of Ahlul Bayt, going to war is not a bad thing.
It's a good thing.
Especially if it's defending. Of course, we have to also mention as the main point, which is that all these wars that the West is doing is, you know, unjust offensive attacks against innocent people.
Exactly.
So obviously the soldiers are going to get confused and want to kill themselves after they've killed innocent people.
Exactly.
Okay? They're human beings.
That's the consequences of killing innocent
the
people.
Whole, you see, it's crazy. The whole military structure in the West tries to somehow create soldiers that will be immune to the effects of killing innocent people.
Yes.
This is the craziness they've reached.
Yes. But it doesn't work. It
doesn't work. You're dealing with human beings. There's a, you know, you can't change human nature.
No, you can't.
Human nature, however you are, wherever you come from, whether it's Alabama or, you know, whether it's Iran or wherever, you know, human nature is repulsed by killing innocent other human beings.
Human beings, it is.
But it is not repulsed by defending against an unjust attack.
Exactly.
It considers it honorable. It considers it dignified. It considers it to be heroic. It considers dying on that way to be heroic. That's why you see that in Britain, because, you know, we like to complain about Britain.
Yeah, we
but
do.
When the British were defending themselves against the Germans' attack.
That's right. They called it their finest hour.
Because it was their finest
hour.
Because Germans were attacking them, you know, unjustified, you know, in the context of these people fighting each other, you know. And so people stood up, and Churchill came and said, "We will, you know, what was that?
We'll fight them on the beaches.
We'll fight them
on the fields.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is your natural right as a human being to defend yourself.
Absolutely.
If you're being attacked by another nation,
sure.
unjustly.
Sure.
So we get it. Mm. The West gets defense.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we don't have these problems in Iran with our soldiers and the people who went to the war. And we don't have the problems of the soldiers integrating back into society. And we don't have the problems of the families and the widows and the orphans that are that are left over. This is a natural part of human life. When you get attacked, you defend, and those who did it are the greatest heroes.
And the other thing that has to be mentioned,
and this is the path. This is the path of the imams, and this is something that a leader like Imam Khomeini understands.
Yes.
And that's why he said that famous sentence. Again, we're going back to this great, immense, intense personality.
Mm.
He says, the war is a great blessing.
Exactly. Because the other great blessing out of that is also martyrdom. Because martyrdom is a great victory, isn't it?
Listen, people can't wrap their heads around this. Mm. I'm talking about religious people.
Sure.
I'm talking about people who are, you know, in favor of the religion. Imam says, because we're so indoctrinated by this Western thinking of war as a necessary evil.
Mm.
And then the Imam says, it's a great blessing. The war
it's
is a great blessing.
Blessing.
The doors of heaven are opened up, go.
Mm.
And they went.
They went, yes.
And they went. And we're still here.
I know, pity.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yes.
And people who weren't there at that time, they don't understand.
No. They don't know what that meant.
Right.
Yeah, I think basically we're at the end of this particular session in terms of what we were discussing in polarization, you know, with the theme during the war. But of course, you know, this is something that even carries on beyond that.
Right.
And it is, there's no doubt, it's an emotional topic, because really, I mean, when we stand up for truth and we really go according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt and understand the teachings of the Quran. And of course, you know, when God says that, you know, if you fight for Allah's cause, you die for Allah's cause, then death is not applicable in this situation. You're living.
You're not. The martyrs are not dead.
They're not dead.
They live and they're sustained by their God.
They're sustained by their God. And that's what Imam Khomeini re-inculcated back into the Muslim Ummah. This idea that it's not only a great thing to defend your country and to defend your values and to defend your principles.